Accession number 19049, Reel 2.
Malcolm Connolly, Reel 2.
The next place of any consequence we pulled into was Basingstoke. We were allowed to disembark from our train at Basingstoke station, but the military authorities had made sure that no one would be able to abscond because there was military policemen on every exit and entrance. We managed to stop there, but my memories of Basingstoke, I remember thinking to myself, home is an hour down the road. I wonder when I shall see that again. The WVS ladies were there who gave us sandwiches. And the stay was very short. And then we pulled on out. And the next place I remember stopping was Leicester. We stopped at Leicester. Once again, we was allowed to disembark and walk up and down the station. And once again, the military authorities had made sure we weren't going to abscond because there was military policemen on every entrance and every exit. And once again, the dear ladies of the WVS were giving out packed sandwiches, and you could buy tea at the restaurant there. And we then proceeded. It wasn't very long, just a very short stay, 15 minutes, 20 minutes perhaps. And we then proceeded on up through. It was then by that time getting quite dark, and blackout of course was strictly enforced, so the blinds in the train had to be pulled down, and everybody was looking for somewhere to sleep, which they eventually found. And the train pulled through the night. It was bitterly cold. I remember it being very bitterly cold. And when I woke up again in the early hours of the morning, we knew that we were in Scotland. The thing I remember is the fact that as we pulled through Scotland, people living in terraced houses and would wave to us. But anyway, we pulled into Scotland in the early hours of the morning, and I remember thinking to myself, what the hell is that? And it was one big ship. And I don't suppose there was many of us young men had ever seen a ship of its size. And it was tied up to the docks, which I think was King George V Docks, Gurwick. I wouldn't bet any money on it, but I think that's where it was. We were still not told anything, where we were going and what was going to happen to us. But the outcome of seeing this big liner, which had a number on it, didn't have a name. We didn't discover her name until we actually got on board her. But the young officers then, who had kept well apart from us, they had compartments on the train on their own. Our NCOs that were in charge of the draft had mixed with us. We knew who they were. But the young officers, commanded by a major, they hadn't even spoken to us. But we piled out with all our kit onto the dockside underneath this big liner. And the officers said we had to leave our kit and carry their kit. And they had everything except the kitchen sink on board this liner. So we were detailed. And being very young soldiers, we made no attempt to try and get out of it. But we picked up certain items of the officer's kit and struggled up the gangplank to the main deck of this liner. It was then it suddenly dawned on me that there was two sides to this man's army, because as I attempted to get off the liner, A military policeman armed with a rifle and bayonet stuck it across my front and said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going down to get some." "No," he said, "once you step foot on this liner, you don't get off." End of argument. So the young officers who had detailed us to carry their kit then not only had to carry their what was left of theirs, but also bring ours. But they didn't board the liner. It was handed from the gangplank to us people on the ship itself, onto the liner itself. That was my first lesson of class distinction within the British Army. We then were given a mess deck number and told that we had to go down to this mess deck number, park our kit, so forth, and there would be food at certain time, because we hadn't left really. We had a few sandwiches since we'd left Bovington camp early on the Sunday morning. So we were all, being young and fit and capable, we were all pretty hungry. Anyway, we went down onto the mess deck, and it had a series of large mess tables. This not only was a dining room table for 24 men, 12 up each side of it, but also men slept on it and underneath it. And I can't remember or visualize how many men were on my mess deck, but it ran into many, many hundreds. Because there was 300 of the Royal Armoured Corps draft. And then there was also artillery drafts, all sorts of people. Anyway, we made ourselves comfortable. We drew a hammock. There was no beds as such, it was hammocks. And each man had a hooks on which he could sling his hammock. And then it came over the ship's intercom that we had to detail mess orderlies. These men would be responsible for going to the galleys and getting the food and bringing it back to your particular mess table. We then decided that as we'd actually decided who was going to be on mess deck table one or so forth and so on, that the two men at the head of the table would be responsible for going to the galley and drawing the food for 24 men, and that each man would pay 6 months a week to these individuals. They would do it for a week, and then two other men would take it over, and they would be paid 6 months a week for running backwards and forwards to the galley and keeping the mess deck table clear, clean and tidy, and all the things that you have to do in military life. Our biggest shock was when our meal was actually brought to us. The menu on board this ship, and we was on her for approximately 4 months, 4.5 months, never varied. We had eggs for breakfast, stew for dinner, and fish for tea. The next day you had fish for breakfast, eggs for dinner, and that's how it was. And to be quite truthful, the only good thing I remember was the bread. Each man had a section of bread of so many ounces, which was his entitlement, three times a day with butter. And the bread was the most beautiful bread I think I've ever tasted. But the meals itself was terrible. But we complained to the orderly officer, and even he must have felt sorry for us, because he said he would try and do something about it, but it was never done. We lived on this strict menu for the 4.5 months we was on board her, where we managed to, when we got ashore in Cape Town, we managed to go and buy other things, but on board the ship, it never varied at all.
What was the name of the ship?
And the name of the ship was the ASS Orbita. And we pulled out into the Clyde, and I always remember the day we pulled out into the Clyde because it was my birthday. It was the 17th of February, 1942. And I was then 20 years of age. But that night, I went back to my mess deck, and of course everybody used to smoke a lot in those days. And I looked on the mess deck, and all these hundreds of men all trying to sling a hammock, all smoking their heads off. And you could actually cut the air in block and take it with you. So I decided then and there that was not for me. So I took some blankets, where there were, which was our abundance. We had an abundance of blankets. We were issued with a life belt, also a security light, which had to be attached to your life belt, that if you had to bail out, the ship was sunk or something like that, as soon as it hit the water, it would come on. And we also were issued with an emergency ration, which was really was a giant block of highly vitamized chocolate. And we were warned not to eat it. I think some of the braver souls did try, but they didn't like it very much. And I went upstairs onto the promenade deck, because all the peacetime glory of this ship had gone. The toilets were nothing else but a galvanized steel formed into a V, and these were in most of the main gangways, alleyways, whatever you like to call them, with a pole across the top. And this had continuous salt water running through it all the time. And there was room for 12 or 16 men at a time to use these ablutions. It was okay, it worked. But the only trouble was, when you got into choppy water, when the nose went down, the salt water that ran through these contraptions would surge forward and possibly come right across your knees. And when the nose went up, it would go the other way. So you had to be very, very quick to dodge it on the way down and dodge it on the way back. But it worked. There was no fresh water. The showers were salt water. We was issued with a block of salt water soap. And you cannot wash with salt water. You can't shave with salt water. So we were restricted to one water bottle full of fresh water per day. At a certain given time, we had to parade, line up queue, whatever you like to call it, and there would be armed sentries on this downpipe, and we would take our turns filling up our water bottles. Men didn't steal money or things like that. They stole water bottles because they were so short of it. But upstairs, the officer class was put on their word of honor that they wouldn't waste water. Now, the officer class, who were upstairs on the big decks in the cabins, and they were pretty overcrowded as well, they used to go to mess 7 o'clock every evening, dead on time. So some of us braver souls, who had possibly drunk all their fresh water, would then creep up to the officers' cabins and fill up their water bottles, because the officers' water was on all the time. Some of the braver souls actually had a shower. And all this extra use of water was never discovered. But our restriction of one water bottle per day was enforced from the time we left Glasgow, Scotland, to the time we arrived in Bombay. We pulled into West Africa, Sierra Leone, and it was one of the most funniest incidents I remember, because while we were tied up, we had a cloudburst. And tropical cloudbursts really are something to see. But instead of everybody rushing to take cover, they all stripped off and had a bath. Where the soap came from, I don't know, but everybody seemed to have a bar of soap and fully expecting it. And after the shower had terminated, it came over the ship's blowers that in future, any cloudburst, all ranks could take advantage and shower. But we'd already done it anyway. The only other funny thing I remember about the SS Orbita, because life on her wasn't very funny at all, was that just before we left Scotland, it came over the ship's blower that the Royal Armoured Corps draft had been chosen to take part in the ship's defences. They had the big gun at the back. Don't ask me what size it was, but it was a real big gun. And it was manned by Dems gunners, which were all Royal Artillerymen. But all the Harlequins and machine guns, Bren guns and so forth around, were manned by the men on board the ship. And we had been chosen to man the Harlequins. It was a gun that none of us had ever seen. None of us had ever fired. But we was chosen. And we was left to our own devices of how to learn how to fire this strange weapon. Which, of course, we did. And we had learned our lessons in Bovington Camp exceedingly well, because on the way into West Africa, we'd had an air raid alarm. And our orders were, those who manned the defences of the ship, was that anything flying over the convoy, indifferent to what colours, what markings they might have, would be open fire on. I don't remember whether they were British aircraft, whether they were German aircraft, or whether they were French aircraft. All I remember was the amazing sight of the Navy protecting its flock. And that is a sight to be seen, because the destroyers and corvettes cut through the water just like greyhounds and sheepdogs looking after the flocks of their sheep. And they actually put a curtain of fire. They don't, as far as I know, they don't actually fire at a target, but they put a blanket of fire over the complete convoy. So anything that's attacking the convoy has to go through that curtain of fire to get at us. Anyway, this happened. We were never told what or why, who they were, what they were, or what had happened to them. We pulled into Lion Head and we went into West Africa. And the amazing thing there was the locals who came to sell us wares, bumboats. They came with these most rickety of craft, hollowed out of tree trunks and so forth and so on. And there was bartering, and they were loaded up with mangoes, bananas, things like that. Well, after we'd been on board her, which must have been 6 weeks, I suppose, these things were an absolute luxury. And there was a lot of bartering and bantering going on, and a lot of the natives that had come to sell us the wares, I'm sure, had been trained in the big markets of London, because they were far, far more wily than what we were. But anyway, we was there for 3-4 days while the damage done by the gunners to the mainmast, because they chopped some of the wires away. And then we proceeded out of there down, and our next port of call was Cape Town. Cape Town, of course, is one of my better memories. Cape Town, the people of Cape Town actually took to us as though we were their sons. Their hospitality is beyond any words that I can describe. They picked us up, they took us home, they fed us and they watered us, and they were on the side of the ship to see us depart. And then the convoy itself seemed to diminish, where, because half of it had actually gone into Durban. What happened to that, I don't know. But nobody told us anything. We had managed to come up to the up to date with newspapers and what the South African people had told us, that Tobruk had fallen and things weren't very good. The Japanese were overrunning the Far East, and life didn't look too healthy anyway. Some said we were going to Singapore. That couldn't have possibly been so, because Singapore had already fallen. then the rumours were we were going to land at Rangoon. And I do believe that we did get up as far as Burmese waters. But the time we got there, that Rangoon was closed, and we scarpered then back to Cape Town. We weren't allowed to disembark. The rumours then were that we was going into Madagascar. We didn't go to Madagascar because it had already fallen. The British troops that had landed there in the first place had already taken it. So then we finished up in India. India, of course, you can smell miles out to sea anyway. We knew we was going to India. And we were then told to put our tropical kit on. And we landed in, what was the name of the place? Alexandra Docks, Bombay. And we had everything packed for to disembark. The infantry battalions that were also on board with us, we had on board on the Orbiter, the Norfolks and the Royal Scots, apart from lots and lots of small drafts like the Royal Armoured Corps draft. And these people were disembarked wearing their kit. And they were marched away, and that was the last we saw of them. But we had an officer come on board, and I well remember his name because we'd never seen anything like him before. And he was a real old sweat. He'd been in India a long time, a Captain Gregory. And he immediately pulled his shirt off, squatted down on the deck, and said, "You have the choice. You can either go to the 25th Dragoons, these two famous regiments, the 25th Dragoons or the 26th Hussar. And if you've made friends, if it's possible, you can stay with them." So we were paraded down on the docks, carrying all our kit, which was quite considerable. And he looked at us and he said, "The United Kingdom have sent us the dregs." Well, after 4.5 months on board a troop ship, washing in salt water, we weren't, I suppose, the sight that was going to save the empire. But anyway, he said, "I won't be seen with you." And with that, he disappeared. We'd already then been split into two parts, those going to the 25th Dragoons and those going to the 26th Hussar, and I'm talking about the part that was going to the 26th Hussar. About a half an hour later, he turns up with an Indian, who immediately we lined up, and he started to measure up for trousers, a shirt, an Indian topi, and within a matter of a couple of hours or so, the people were, I suppose, there must have been 300, at least 150 of us, was suddenly had a new uniform. We had an Indian made tailored trousers and shirt with 26s R in red elaplets on our shoulders, and we had an Indian topi, not the old woolsey topi. And he said, "You can throw that into the docks." All our tropical kit that we'd so laboriously brought from the United Kingdom was just unceremoniously just dumped overboard, and I suppose the Indians must have picked it up and took it away. But we just slung it away. And then we were taken to Victoria Station in Bombay, where there was an Indian style train, not a vast difference to the British, where everybody has an individual seat upholstered. These are nothing else but wooden forms with a toilet at the end. And we just piled in there, dumped our kit, found somewhere to sit or lay. And the toilet had no water and was encrusted from the previous people. But each stop, and it did stop because the Indian railways, if I remember correctly, were a single line with loop lines. So if one was coming down from Calcutta, another one coming out from Bombay, one went into a loop line while the other one passed, and so forth and so on. And the only other thing about Indian railways I remember is the fact that everyone, doesn't matter how isolated the station may be, it always had a fountain. Because the Indians who sit on the roof, hang on the side, sit on the bumpers, sit anywhere, get anywhere, just suddenly pile off and go and wash themselves, usually wash their legs and their face, and then rush back to where they've been sitting or clinging on the train. And this becomes a way of life. If you're in India very long, even British other ranks used to do exactly the same thing. Rush to the fountain, wash their hands and their face and so forth and so on. And eventually, the only good thing was that you, every station, you had the barrage of charwallas and fruitwallas and all these people coming to sell you tea, under banjos, which is an egg sandwich, char, you had to have your own mug, your own piala. Piala is Hindi for mug. And you never ever called it a mug, it was always a piala. And if you wanted a egg sandwich, it was never an egg sandwich, it was always an under banjo. And eventually we arrived in Pune, where we was given tea, cha, and under banjo, and we transferred then from the broad gauge to the narrow gauge to go to this isolated, very isolated spot called Naira Camp. When we got to Naira Station, we fully expected transport to take us from Naira Station to Naira Camp, which was approximately 10 miles. But no, there was transport there for our kit, a couple of old Indian buses. And the NCOs that were there were real old Indian, been in India for a long time. And they took a high delight in telling us that we would have to march from Naira Station to Naira Camp, and it was exceedingly hot. When we got to Naira Camp, it was just one big expanse of nothing. It was a desert. But there was piles and piles and piles and piles of tents. And our job was, we would have to erect these tents ready for the regiment to come down from the northern part of India, Selkot. So we immediately started erecting these tents. There was a cookhouse there with an Indian cook, Babaji, who fed us. And all the NCOs and the officers were all men who'd been in India quite some considerable time. And I full remember one old soldier saying to me, "How long have you been in the army then, boy?" I said, "Oh, 8 months." He said, "I've been here 12 years. And I think, in fact, I know, I went to my bed that night and I cried. Because I thought, well, if he's been here for 12 years, I shall never go home." And the effect that these old soldiers had on young soldiers like us, like me, was quite considerable. Because the country, the United Kingdom, our country, had taken these men pre-war to India. And if you'd signed for a regiment for 7 years and 5 years, you had to do the complete service in India. And of course, a lot of them had been in India for at least 7 years, very least 7 years. And of course, some of them had married Indian girls and had Indian families. And they really didn't want to go home. A lot of them didn't. But the effect that they had on people